Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to a special broadcast coming to you live from the Dayton Hamvention 2009, the world's largest amateur radio gathering, with special guests Chip Margelli, K7JA of Heil Sound, Bob Heiler, K9EID of Heil Sound, Gordon West, WB6NOA of Gordon West Schools, Dr. Michael Barrett, N4ECW of Transworld Antennas, Richard Garriott, K9KWQ, recipient of the Hamvention 2009 Special Achievement Award, Martin Jew, K5FLU of MFJ Enterprises, Wade D. Danny Hampton Jr., K4ITL, winner of the Amateur of the Year Award, Cop Thorne Cop McDonald, VY2C, winner of the Technical Excellence Award, Michael Coulter, W8CI, the Public Relations Director of the 2009 Dayton Hamvention, and many, many more. Now here's your host, Ted Randall.
Hello there. We're coming to you from Dayton, Ohio. It's the 2009 Dayton Hamvention, and there's only one like it. Only one like it in the country. And with me is Ted Alexander. Hello, Ted.
Hello, Ted. Sounds like an echo here. Two Teds in one.
Let me do this again. Hello, okay. Ted.
Hello, Ted.
That's what I thought happened, but I wasn't absolutely sure. Ted's call is W8IXY. Boy, that sure has a Cleveland ring to it.
There was a legendary rock and roll station in Cleveland called Wixie 1260. And when it came time to go for a call sign change for a vanity call, I had a call for like 48 years, which was K8VPL, which didn't really ring too well. So I said, since I've been a lifelong broadcaster, let's go for something that sounds like broadcasting. So I am now Wixie 29160 on that, a good old 10 meters.
Well, on in Wixie in Cleveland, I'm thinking of Chuck Dunaway.
Is that Chuck was there in the 60s as well, right?
All right. Now didn't he... He was on the air, but didn't he return to, like, run the station at one point? Wasn't
he was the program director of Wixie for a while. He worked at the old WKYC 1100 in Cleveland and then went over to Wixie 1260 as well and ran that, along with many, many of the other stations that he was with over the years.
Well, you know, what comes to mind is a gentleman that worked at CKLW by the name of Steve Hunter.
Yes.
That left Detroit. And then went to Wixie in Cleveland. And
Wixie had hired him away when CKLW had such a potent signal and did so well in the Cleveland ratings. They said, well, let's join him instead of fight him. So they brought Steve Hunter in back in the 60s as well for Wixie.
Boy, he was a fireball on the air.
Boy, and how. You know, powerhouse jock. You know, one of those the fast-talking shotgun type of jocks. Made rock and roll radio so much fun.
They used to call him... Now, what did they call him? I'm trying to think. Pat Holiday had a name for him. Steve Stars is what he called him. Steve Stars, you know. And a lot of people called him Hunta because he, H-U-N-T-A, because he, the way he'd come across, he talks so fast. You know, Steve Hunta, you know, or Steve, you know. And, but he was, I'm trying to think what, at CKLW, he was on like 7 to 10 or something like that.
It was later in the day. I can't remember if it was afternoon or evening.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was like, of course, that station was like, you know, it was a legend, I mean, but it was like you had just this incredible following or audience. Of course, the signal was just,
It had a super signal. It was right on the border between the USA and Canada. It was beamed into Detroit in one direction and right through Lake Erie East. It covered Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Akron, got into Buffalo, Erie, all those stations. And with low on the dial with high power, just rang out with that signal.
Yeah, we've been advertising the Markham Street Films production, The Rise and Fall of the Big Eight, Radio Revolution. We've been advertising that, and there's a lot of folks that I think have an interest in that. I'm going to turn my bottom end down a little bit. Sounds like it's coming through a little bit too much. You currently now work for a broadcast company.
I work for several. I work for, you know, contract basis for radio stations, and the main company that I'm with is the company that makes most of the talk show equipment that you hear on the networks over the pretty much, you know, Premier Radio Networks uses our equipment. the you know, Dave Ramsey show. We were talking about Dave before we got on the air here. They use our equipment. We make the telephone talk show equipment. And remember when Art Bell was broadcasting from the Philippines, he used this device called a Zephyr.
Yep.
It allows high-quality transmission around the world on what they call ISDN digital phone lines. We make those as well.
That, but those things also, they have an interface now that, that works on TCP. TCP IP. I can't talk.
Okay. Yes, yes. The Zephyr Extreme, the Zephyr IP, and it allows you, if you have a DSL connection, you can be on the air anywhere in the world with hi-fi stereo audio, as long as you can get into the internet.
How reliable is that thing on you know operating on an internet IP address?
Really, it's as reliable as the internet. Now, those of you familiar with the computer technology, you have either quality of service or non-quality of service guarantees for your networks. If you're on a local LAN or a WAN, you've got your quality of service guarantee, and it's absolutely impeccable. And on the internet, what the Zephyr IP does, it has error correction and agile connection technology, which does forward error correction. It does buffering, dynamic buffering on it as well, to the error correction like you would see on CDs and stuff like that, to allow for nearly interruption-free audio.
Well, I've been impressed over the years, I guess I want to say. And I was lucky enough to watch a masterwork. I was able to spend some time with Ed Budabaugh, mm-hmm. who was the chief engineer for CKLW at the time. And I think he, for the record, built the very, very first commercial multiband audio processor to ever hit the air.
There were two or three engineers in the country, and Ed was one of them experimenting with that. KFRC, the chief engineer whose name I can't remember now, he experimented with multiband out in San Francisco at a legendary station out there. CKLW had that RCA transmitter, and it always had that CKL. It had a bottom end, but it wasn't boomy. It had that just big in-your-face sound that he was able to tune. He took commercial processors, added his own touches to them, and his own creativity, made it sound like no other. He was an absolute genius in the sound of audio.
I remember those. It was either LA-3s or LA-4s or something that he...
Yeah, the URI, yeah. The type of limiters.
That's what he used, and he used mm-hmm. his own equalization process mm-hmm. in there. And, boy, I'll tell you, that thing really sounded good. Mm-hmm. You know, really, really,
yes,
really did.
I mean, he was ahead of his time by 40 years.
And, of course, those towers were out in Haro, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody ever saw them. And nobody knew where this, you know, the CKLW transmitter was like anonymous, you know. It had the Klingon cloaking device. Nobody knew where it was.
But nobody cared because when that thing was rocking out, you could hear it everywhere. So you didn't have to get close to the towers to hear the thing.
You know, those calls would just come in from everywhere.
Yes.
You know, I had an interesting thing just happen to me. Are you familiar? I don't want to make you wait a long time. Let's hold the radio thought for a minute. I want to find out about Joe over here with the cat in the hat on over here. K0NEB. And tell me a little bit about what you're doing here.
Okay, well, Ted.
Hang on, let me find the right mic.
There we go.
No, I don't know. Let's see. Thump on that mic a little bit.
Not there. Okay.
Try
one,
it again.
Two. There we go.
Yeah.
Now
okay.
We're starting to hear it. I'm Joe, K0NEB from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I'm the moderator of the kit building forum here in Dayton.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now tell me a little bit about that.
Well, a lot of times people think that kit building is a lost art, but it really isn't. Actually, in the early 90s, when the Heath Kit Company went out of business, everybody thought that kit building was dead. Well, it was. There wasn't anybody making a lot of new kits, and then all of a sudden a whole new generation of kits came about, and now we have just some incredible quality kits made by companies all over here, and some of them you can put together in 10 or 15 minutes and have a 40-meter, 5-watt CW transmitter on the air, and some of them take you maybe several hours. But there's a whole variety of new kits. They're very high quality and very easy to build.
I was going to say, I'm going to yell at my son David here just for a second. KG4WXW. We want to get a picture of Joe to put up on the website because he's got this this cat in the hat on with a whip antenna off the top. He's got some sort of an LED sign scrolling across. And then let's see here, the PFR-3 yellow button that's that's flashing on and off. And we've got to get a picture of this and get this up on the website. Well, you know, you're right. I grew up in the Heathkit era, and I was lucky enough to where I had some of the older fellows would bring me their kits, honest to goodness, and they would say, can you put this together for me? And when you get right down to it, they tell you, well, I can't see real good. But they wanted the pride of having a kit put together and then running the thing. Of course, I think some of them were doing it just to accommodate me, if you follow what I'm saying. To
well, there's a few, like I said, very easy new CW transmitter kits that even a first-time builder can complete in 15 or 20 minutes that puts out a 5-watt CW signal. And amazingly, they can make contacts on it within 30 minutes of unzipping the bag. And that gives them that feeling that, hey, I can make anything. I can make something that I made a contact on in 15 minutes.
And that used to be staple. In other words, most of the time, most guys, and I don't know how it is with you, Ted, but back when I first got on the air, everybody built their own one-tube or possibly two-tube CW transmitter out of junk parts.
We would do that. We had a thing back in high school. Who overnight in 24 hours could build somewhere up to a 5-watt transmitter and bring it in the next day? And usually you took like an audio output tube or a small RF type of tube and a crystal and a handful of parts, and you had yourself a little CW transmitter. Now, you could actually use on the air.
Joe, tell me, how many different... Well, I know we got Elecraft over here, and they're doing kits. You know, I know they do kits. But who all else is here at Dayton that has and is
just
offering?
Just a couple rows farther over from him in this same room, there's Hendrix QRP kits, which makes a whole line of QRP transceivers, including single sideband, and they're all quite inexpensive. And then you have the Tunitin guy from Maine, and he's making transmitters and receivers that fit in a tuna fish can. And
you know what's funny? They're actually sealed up. In other words, you got to take a can opener and open the can to get the parts out.
Exactly. I mean, it's got a zip-top lid. And
unbelievable.
You zip the top off, and there's the kit parts and the board.
Well, he's got pop-tops now.
Yes, he has pop-tops now.
The ones that I saw back a little while ago, they weren't pop-tops. They were actual, you took a can opener and opened the thing. You know?
Exactly, and now they're pop-tops. There's all sorts of them. Let's see, Ramsey Electronics is just over there, and they have several good kits that are great for beginners. We have the Crystal Set Society is here, and they are selling Marconi-style crystal sets that are absolutely incredible. Great reception. He's able to hear like 15 or 20 AM stations from Lawrence, Kansas, which is in the Kansas City metro area.
Wow.
And sometimes, like he said, he hears KFAB from Omaha, which is a 50 kilowatt or closer to me. And I've played with crystal sets at home, but not had as good a luck, but I haven't tried one of his yet. And they're just absolutely incredible. And, boy, do you learn about radio.
I'm getting a hand sign. What does that mean? You can't hear him? Well, he sounds fine on the headphones. You can hear yourself, can't you?
Oh, yes.
Okay, Now there's a fellow across the way here who's got some hearing aids if you'd like to go get and they're in kit form, you know. So.
Like anything they say here, Ted, if you can't find it at Dayton, if it has to do with amateur radio or hobby radio, if you can't find it or at least a source of it at Dayton, it doesn't exist.
You'll have to excuse me here now. See, I'm trying to turn the unused microphones down because we got so much crowd noise in here. You know, and I can just imagine after we run through several stages of commercial audio processing how loud that is on the air right now. So we're trying to contain ourselves here. Wasn't there at one point somewhere along the line in QST or someplace there was a kit they advocated you building it called the Tuna 2 or something?
The Tuna Tin 2. And that's currently being sold down the hall over here in this same room. And you can go over and look at them. They're a wonderful little kit that really doesn't take more than an hour or two to put together. The longest part many times is winding the toroidal coils, but then you learn how to do that as well. And they're very effective little QRP transmitters. I've made many a contact on those, and they want to know what I'm running, and I send them an email with a photo of what my transmitter was. Now, the way I got started in kit building was I was about 9 years old, and I was taken over to World Radio in Council Bluffs, and I built a globe kit. And then there were several other educational kits. And then when I went to college, I decided, well, I want to do kits again. Started building a lot of Heath kit stuff when I was in college. Of course, in college, I studied broadcasting. I was a broadcast major. But I went on into the information services industry, and I work in IT.
Well, that's interesting. Of course, you know, ham radio, I don't care if you're working in electronics of any kind. Ham radio really enhances a person's career. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. I mean, it really does.
It really does. And, in fact, I like to encourage people to try a kit and put it together and really enjoy the experience. And once you've done that, you're going to build something more complex and more complex, and the knowledge that you gain about radio is just incredible. In fact, there's a super regenerative receiver kit over there at QRPKits.com that could listen to this broadcast.
There you go, yeah. But, you know, there's something else, and I want to see this rewarding about putting a kit together, and that is when you get something that is, let's say, complex. When I mean complex, like, an SB, a Hot Water 101. Okay, it's a relatively complex kit, radio transceiver. You get that thing, and the box came in from Heathkit. You opened it up. You did your parts layout. You know, you got all your parts laid out and everything. You start going through it step by step, one thing at a time. And, of course, the first few kits you build, usually they don't work when you first turn them on. You've got a problem somewhere. You've messed up something. But when you finally get down to the point where the thing arrives in a box and you open it up and you lay out all the parts, and you go one step at a time, you get to the end of the line, you throw the switch, and the thing comes on, and you actually hear sound coming out of the speaker, and all you go through your alignment, your little bit of your alignment process. I mean, it's like, it's really, it just kind of blows your mind, you know.
Well, you hear the sounds of the world coming through it, Ted, and then even the greater part of that reward is you connect it up to an antenna. If you've built a device that transmits, you're talking about an HW101, or years ago I built an SB101 and an SB401 transmitter, too. You connect that to the antenna, and you see that this complex piece of equipment that you put together with your own efforts works, and you can talk halfway around the world with it. And it's just fascinating to know that you've crafted this yourself. Even though the parts came from a Heathkit, you did the soldering, you did the connecting, you did the aligning, you did the tuning, you built the antenna, and you're talking to the world. You don't have to worry about a cell tower in between. You don't have to worry about some other kind of a relay station or something. It's your antenna in your house that's radiating out to the world.
I built a Heathkit AA100. Stereo audio amp once, and that was that particular kit went together really well. And when I was done and I turned it on, and I mean, it worked first time around. Mm-hmm. And that's when it starts to really get good, you know.
Well, the satisfaction that you get when you've actually put together something yourself and then make contacts with it, or it does something that shows somebody, hey, this is what I built, there's a lot of satisfaction there. But now it's gone back to what the Heathkit brought to ham radio, and that is lower cost, higher performance. So you're now spending less to get higher quality radios now through kits again, which kind of went away when you had the flood of Japanese radios in the 80s. A kit just didn't have all the features. Well, now a lot of these kits have more features than some of those other radios.
Yeah, I remember, though, at the time, if you did a Heathkit, it really was not that much less expensive.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I put together several Heathkit TVs over the years, and you were going to pay $600 for a TV set from a store. You paid $600 to Heathkit. But the quality was at least as good, if not better, than you get from a store. And then eventually all electronics do break. And when those kits break, you have the advantage. You put it together. So you know where to go to try to troubleshoot the thing and repair it yourself.
Oh, yeah. And it's the satisfaction, the knowing, you know, that you're... One of the things I think that got to me was is once you put one of these things together, you begin to notice or identify the circuitry in portions. In other words, you
And the good thing about that is that it enables you to modify other people's circuits and other radios or improve on the kit itself. And that's one of the neat things you can do with it. Since you've already worked on it, you know how to fix it, you know how to work with it, now you can actually... modify it and improve on the circuit, because most kit manufacturers encourage you to do that, because that's part of radio. You can say, hey, you know, if I increase the voltage on this stage just this much, transistor might get a little warmer, but wow, look at the performance difference, or something like that. There's just a whole myriad of improvements you can do. In fact, at the Crystal Set Marconi kit, it's got terminals on the front. You can try different detectors, a 1N34 diode or a cat's whisker or a razor blade thing like they did in World War II. You can make any different kind of detector and put it on those two terminals and try different things.
I've got to go check out the Crystal Set place. I've always been fascinated with Crystal Sets, and we'll have to go over there and...
Yeah, no batteries, no whatever the RF you pull out of the air into your antenna,
it's
that
RF
powers the whole radio. Yep.
Something interesting that happened to me here just last night. We went out to get something to eat, and I happened to flip on the 2-meter radio, and I was calling Dave Wilson. You know Dave, or do you know Dave? Dave Wilson, works for the Cromwell Group. Their chief engineer is KU4B is his call sign.
May have talked to him over the years.
Okay, well he's mobile. He's got a couple of fellows with him, and so I put this call out. And this guy comes back to me, you know. And I was calling Dave, but this guy came back, and he was just making conversation. And I said, "Well, where are you from originally?" He said, "Well, I spent about 30 years in the Detroit area." And I said, "Really?" And I said, "Well, I spent about 30 years in the Detroit area, you know." And we began to talk, and so I said, "Well," he said, "Well, what did you do?" I said, "I worked in radio." He said, "Well, I worked in radio in Detroit." I said, "Well, where did you work at?" I said, "I was at WKNR for a little while, and I was at CKLW." He says, "Well, that's where I work, too." So it turned out the gentleman's name was Ed Bush. And Ed Bush worked at WKNR, Keener 13 in Detroit. I remember that very well because I was very young. He may be a little older than I, but I went in and I talked to the program director there at the time, who was Paul Cannon. And Paul said to me, he says, "You don't want to go into this business." He says, "You get it out of your system. You don't want to go into this business." And about that time, out of the FM control room came Ed Bush and came into Paul Cannon's office, and we had a conversation. But I had heard Ed both on the AM and on Keener AM and Keener FM. And then I found out he worked at CKLW back prior to the Drake days, just prior to Drake.
I have some old tapes of him that I recorded in Cleveland, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was kind of interesting. He's here at the Dayton Hamvention.
Is he?
Floating around somewhere.
Well, you talk about another coincidence there, Ted, that WKNR, where you worked, the call letters used to be in Detroit. They're now in Cleveland, and I'm a contract engineer with WKNR in Cleveland.
Oh, really?
So you talk about how it just goes. It's almost like a closed society of broadcast engineers as well.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there used to be a broadcast transmitter that you ordered for your radio station that came in kit form.
Yes, it
really?
Did.
Yes.
And the Bowers.
The Bowers 707. You know, I've seen a number of people who actually assembled those things, and they look better than factory. One fellow was named Chester Davis, and he had the radio station in Hartsville, Tennessee. At the time, the call sign was WJKM. And incidentally, let's just stop right here and now let everybody know, people tuning in say, "What is this? What's going on here?" We are coming to you live from the 2009 Dayton Hamvention in Dayton, Ohio. Yes, the very, very famous, largest amateur radio event in the entire world. And that's where we are coming from. And with me is Joe, K0NEB, who has, you'd have to see this to believe it. I mean, you know, if you didn't hear the man talk, you'd be very, very skeptical of striking up a conversation with him. He's got this great big gigantic cat in the hat thing on, a antenna coming off the top, an LED sign, which is saying CQ, 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 and his call sign, and a little button that says PFR-3, LED flashing on and off, and then across the table is Ted Alexander, who is currently in the broadcast field, works with Omnia Axia. And
in the USA, you might hear me on your TV set doing
really?
Things like that says to order something or other, call 1-800 or go to timelife.com.
Oh.
You'll hear me on those late-night TV spots once in a while there, too.
And his call sign is W8IXY. And as soon as I said IXY, of course, I had to get to talking about Cleveland radio. So in our kit situation, we do have Elecraft here. We have the tuna, the tin kit tuna kits. Mm-hmm. How do I want to say this? The tuna tin kit guy is here.
Yes.
What's the name of his company? Do you know?
QRPME, QRPME.com, because he's from Maine.
Okay, so he is here. You were talking about some other folks.
Yes, there's hamgadgets.com, and they're from Omaha, mm-hmm. and they have a whole new line of keyer and controller kits. There are several kits scattered throughout the complex. Kanga US has a whole line of kits, and they're in the main arena. A lot of QRP kits. And there's a lot of kits that are just worthwhile for shack accessories and stuff. Things like little antenna tuners and so forth. I just picked up a kit that's a switch line tuner. I can hook kind of a long wire to it and a ground, and I can either hook it to a low power transceiver or my general coverage shortwave receiver, so I can resonate my long wire. It goes out to the tree and hear WBCQ or WRMI a lot clearer in Nebraska by tuning the antenna with this little inexpensive line tuner kit.
Well, what about parts? You know, I mean, parts used to be pretty plentiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could build things up by just looking in the junk, you know.
And some of the old ham radio guys that came from New York, the Cortland Street Radio Row in New York City, which has been gone for years. There used to be a number of radio parts stores in pretty much every town, every small town to every large city. Over and over again, you'd just go down the street and see a parts store after a parts store. And that's kind of gone away. The neighborhood parts stores, it's gone more toward email now. You get on to, you know, the parts ordering done online ordering as well. You can see a lot of that. In fact, Ted, I was thinking you were talking about, I think they have a picture of Joe and his hat on hamvention.org or one of the sites. If somebody is sitting there in front of their computer right now and wants to dial up, either put in ham radio on a search engine or hamvention.org, and you can see because his picture has been around for a few years.
Yes.
I've seen it
also
here and there.
Also, if you just Google my call sign, K0NEB, in the images, you'll see several of them that are online. Also, I produce slideshows that are set to music. I take kind of popular older songs, mostly classic rock, and I create slideshows set to music carefully to the words of the songs to commemorate each year's hamvention. Every year I come up with two of them. This year's are The Cars, Just What I Needed, and Sticks, Too Much Time on My Hands, and we're going to have all sorts of fun.
Okay, well, that sounds good. Now, your official position with the kit situation here, tell me what this is, because I know you told me, but
I'm the moderator of the kit building forum, which we held earlier today, and we had several kit manufacturers as guests talking about all the latest and greatest.
Oh, very, very good. Now, the kit building forum, do you have a presence online at all, or is that?
No, we don't.
Okay. So it's.
But we also have a group called HBQRP in Nebraska that I'm a member of. We have about 18 to 20 of us that show up once a month, and we build kits. And there's all sorts of groups like that popping up all over the country now.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because oddly enough, I had Wayne Green tell me that kit building was all over, and he said, I don't know if he was kidding me, he may, knowing him, that could have just been his sense of humor, you know. I'll bet you it was.
I had Wayne Green on some talk shows in years gone by as well, and Wayne, being the intelligent man that he is, I mean, the mind that just doesn't quit, he'd pull your leg once in a while.
It's definitely not dead.
I wouldn't think so. No. But you know, you're going to try to build a little antenna tuner. Let's say you just want to build a little tiny antenna tuner. I mean, where do you? I mean, there used to be places like Fair Radio, and I don't know if they're still around. Are they?
I think Fair Radio still is. There's a huge surplus store here in Dayton as well, Mendelssohn's. And then several of the other ones, too, that have surplus parts, where if you want to build this antenna tuner, you could just literally, for pennies, get commercial type of, you know, used or, you know, decommissioned from military service or something, parts.
And there's a place at home, too, in Omaha called Surplus Sales of Nebraska.
You know, I'm trying to think. Who used to be? Was it a microphone company? Was it Turner Mics? It used to be in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska.
Yeah, I remember turning microphones.
Lincoln. They moved into the high gain complex in Lincoln, and Telex is also there. And
remember the A-Static name? They were in Conneaut, Ohio.
Oh, okay. I remember. Yeah,
they had the D-104.
D-104. They had a lot of crystal mics. Yes. A lot of crystal microphones. You know what's amazing though? Did you ever see these little mics? They look like the old RCA DX77s, okay, but they're not. They're a crystal microphone imitation. They have two crystals in them, and some of them mics have a switch where you can either series or parallel the crystals, I guess, to do
different responses and things, yeah.
But Olson Electronics used to sell those things for $4.95.
Yep. Then this big old crystal element about an inch and a half diameter sitting in there. And you thought you were on the air when you were a kid.
Well, they actually had two. They had them inverted, one over the top of the other, and you kind of talked between the two crystals. They had a pretty high output too because of the two crystals being connected together, or two crystal elements. But $4.95 from Olson Electronics. I see them on eBay now in excess of $100, $200. I guess it's because they look like
the real thing.
They look like the 77, and then I've seen artwork where people are taking pictures of these things, you know, and putting them in a there's a classic radio type photograph that people hang in the hallway, and it's a picture of one of those microphones. It makes me ill when I see it because it's not a real. I mean, I guess there were some folks that used it as a communications mic.
The Olson mic you're talking about?
Yeah, I think some people used it like a D-104, although it really sounded tinny. I mean, it was a sonic.
Well, for $5.
It was a sonic horror show. Yeah, it was horrible. But you still see these things around, and it's that's kind of interesting.
And Bob Heil, with his microphone business, he has had several of the his microphones that imitated the Diamond mic, the RCA, the 44BX.
Right.
He had out on there. And even Shure, I think I can't remember if they went back to manufacturing it or what. The Elvis microphone, that thing about the size of a grapefruit that had the grills all the way around
yep.
it. You see Elvis holding that in some of his early performances.
Heil still sells those.
Still those sell those too.
Yeah, that thing is called, I think it's called the Heritage.
Yes.
We didn't bring one of those with us, but he's got them over there at his booth.
But again, I mean, if you're looking for a picture of it, I'm sure it's, you know, you can find it online, just put it on a search engine.
Yeah, the funny one, and we brought one here, but I don't know where it's at. It's not, you have to run? Mm-hmm. Joe has to run. So I'm going to let you go ahead and give your final words here.
Thank you very much. In fact, I got started in ham radio listening to shortwave broadcast, and so it's always fun to get on shortwave radio again.
And when you were getting started, tell us quickly, what was it you were listening to?
Radio Havana, Radio Moscow, Radio Netherlands, Swiss Radio International, Radio RSA in South Africa, HCJB in Quito, all the biggies.
There you go. Yeah, I used to, I when I was younger, I used to listen to HCJB and Trans World Radio.
TWR.
They would say from the Island of the Flamingos, you know, that type of thing. I don't know. It was, you know,
well, Ted, you were talking about CKLW being on 800.
Thank you, Joe, for coming by. Not to interrupt you, but I was going to say, I think he needs to go. But thank you for coming by. I appreciate hearing from you, sir, and come back again.
You bet.
We'll
enjoy your show.
Tomorrow, jump back in here again. And for the folks that doesn't hear you today, they'll hear you tomorrow.
Right.
Okay, very good.
Now, Ted, you were talking about Trans World Radio, and when you were on the CKLW, Trans World Radio down on Bonaire had that 500-kilowatt job on 800,
yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I mean, you would hear underneath CKLW all over the whole eastern half of the USA.
Yeah, it was a combination of Aretha Franklin and Back to the Bible. That's what it was.
They would have these big diesel generators down there that would power that that transmitter up. It was just a legendary place. And there aren't that many high-power shortwave stations left. A lot of it's going to satellite and to regional and to FMs. The high-power guys that are left that are fascinating to look at for the listeners who like to look at high-power transmitters, go on and look up some of the long-wave stations over in Europe, like the Droitwich transmitters outside of London for the 500-kilowatt long-wave frequencies that are down around, like 198 or something like that, too. Fascinating things to look at. Look at these devices.
Well, we're right across the aisle here from WC8VOA, which is the Voice of America commemorative club, I guess is what they are. I remember visiting Bethany.
Yes.
The Bethany Relay Station, they called it. And that has been since done away with.
But what a complex that was, Ted, back in the 70s and 80s, because at that time, the old WLW 500-kilowatt transmitter, even though it wouldn't work anymore, enough of it was there to be able to see. And if you're an antenna buff, the antenna systems for the Bethany Relay Station there for the Voice of America, the rhombics and the sturba curtains, phenomenal installation down there. And thank goodness there's a lot of pictures left of that.
Yeah, I remember driving by on I-75, driving by it, and you would look at that over there at the distance, and if you didn't know what it was, you would think in the back of your mind, they've got to be contacting Mars.
They had, miles and miles of wire up there, and you put 250,000 watts into one of those antennas, and your ERP is like 10 million watts, and it's all beamed right out over, into Europe, wherever the part of the world that they want to beam the Voice of America broadcast to.
Well, the thing about the Bethany station was, I guess now, the Bethany station did not actually transmit point to point, did it? I mean, was it... It was not meant to listen to in terms of like a direct transmission.
Some of them were, but they had, I believe there was an independent sideband transmitter there that they used as a relay. They'd have two programs going out over the same transmitter, one on the upper sideband, one on the lower sideband. And if you had a selectable sideband receiver or a synchronous detector, you'd hear two separate programs on it, and that would be relayed somewhere other part of the world where it would be picked up and broadcast locally from, something 8,000 miles away.
Yeah, because back then, before satellites, they were using these things as relays, mm-hmm. It seemed to me like when I visited Bethany, they kind of did a disclaimer thing where they said, we're not, you don't really want to listen to us. You want to listen to the, and I wondered, I thought, well, it's got to come from there. So how could it be, not listenable coming from Bethany, Ohio? And then maybe coming from I guess they would relay to Greenville or someplace across
Greenville,
the country.
Or even just, across the, over to Europe, some of the transmitters that they would share with, like, some of the other shortwave broadcasters.
For those who have just tuned in, I want to say we are broadcasting live from the Dayton Hamvention 2009, and we are here. I'm talking with Ted Alexander, and Ted's call sign is W8IXY. And we're talking old radio stuff. Everybody seems to like that. Incidentally, go to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com, and jump on the website and click on the tab that says Contact Ted. Send us an email. And if you do that, like almost but immediately, we will watch for it, and then we will further antagonize you. For writing us.
Well, when you get to talking radio to the enthusiasts that listen to the show here, Ted, there's nothing that would not be fascinating about radio and every aspect of sending a signal out into the ether. And it's something that so many people just are fascinated with. The youngsters that see ham radio, I can remember the first time I saw ham radio and somebody was actually talking and somebody talked back to him. It was two-way. Bob was over here earlier. We were talking about his first experiences listening to shortwave radio. In the early 50s, we had a radio that would pick up New York World. I said, what in the world is this? Radio New York Worldwide, WNYW. At the time, and which is now call letters on a TV station. And then right at 10 megahertz on the dial was this thing that sent out time signals, WWV. And, you know, with their powerhouse signal as well, everybody all over the USA listened to that and the various other time signals and from different countries around the world, too. CHU in Canada was sending out their time signals. Even these days, on the bottom end of the AM broadcast band and a lot of the eastern USA, you can hear the time ticks from some of the Cuban broadcast stations as well. 570 is one that you hear on the in the eastern USA as well. So there's all kinds of fascinating stuff that all you got to do is put a radio on and start listening.
Well, you know, it's I heard people talk about number stations when I was younger, and I never heard one. You know, I'd always say, "What is a number station?" You know, and I really had never heard it defined. And then one day I was just tuning by, and there was this woman on the air just putting out numbers. It was like bingo with no bingo. You know, mm-hmm. It was. Anyway, I listened for, you know, the longer I listened, the more I realized it was quite an enigma that she was communicating something to somebody, but mm-hmm. We didn't know who it was, you know.
Some kind of a code like that. Yeah, yeah, all the stuff that you hear. And some of the enthusiasts that in the old days you'd have to have a receiver and a terminal unit and a setup to listen to, you know, radio teletype. Now you could do it just on a computer and watch some of the radio teletype things. And there were numbers RITI stations as well. You'd tune in and you hear the ticking of the radio teletype, the dee-dee-dee-dee of the signal, and then you'd see these five-number groups being printed out as that, too. So that was it was not only voice, but it was radio teletype, too.
That was kind of strange. But earlier when he was talking, our Cat in the Hat guy, his name Bob, said that he listened to Havana, Cuba. And I remember hearing, to me it sounded strange, when they do their ID, it was kind of like they said, Radio Habana, Cuba. Mm-hmm. You know, they said it like that, you know. And I would catch certain English names, primarily the names of politicians that would come through. You couldn't understand anything else they were saying, but they would say things like Kennedy.
Yeah, you know? Pick that up.
You know, and you could hear that, you know. But now, of course, in English, you have a chance to listen to them, and I find the news on Radio Havana, Cuba is absolutely hysterical. I mean, it'll have you on the floor.
Well, you listen to news from various other parts of the world with different points of view, and you just don't know who to believe.
Well, I mean, the different points of view, I can understand, mm-hmm. And I've heard that. I mean, you're listening to a signal coming in from some other country, and they put their bias or their spin on the news. But Havana, Cuba. I mean, these guys are like the old 2020 news guys, riffing the news stories, except they stretch reality way out, and they do an Inquirer-type international newscast, which is just, you know.
There were the propaganda broadcasts also from Radio Moscow on about 47 different frequencies that you could hear pretty much everywhere. And some of those are pretty humorous, too. You know, the Soviet Union has disagreed heartily with USA President John F. Kennedy because of something or something or something or other. And a lot of those Radio Moscow stations were right in the middle of some of the ham radio bands, especially the 40-meter band. So even if you had a ham band-only receiver, you'd hear Radio Moscow on those frequencies. And you were talking, Ted, about some of those, the propaganda broadcasts. Again, it was almost laughable. Cuba could have been more laughable because they were not the kind of threat to the USA, directly at least, as the Soviet Union was back in the 60s, especially with the days of the Cuban Missile Crisis as well.
That was a time, though, when propaganda, there was a reason for it. It wasn't done just for entertainment purposes. Mm-hmm. In other words, it was real serious.
Oh, we did that, too, with Radio Free Europe.
Wanting to bend the minds of the listener. Okay. Now, I just want to interrupt here. But we've got someone. We've got a special guest coming over. And I want to get this gentleman to take a seat and point him toward the microphone. This you may want to go ahead and accommodate him with some headphones there. And I see a call sign, and I see WB6IVF, and a name on the hat, and the name on the hat is Jerry. So, hello, Jerry. How are you?
I don't. There we go.
I get the right mic turned on here.
I'm doing really well. I'm Jerry Leary, and I'm with the Unseen Bean Coffee Company here.
The Unseen Bean.
Yes, I'm a blind guy, so I can't see the coffee beans. And when I first was looking to get into the coffee industry, I was told by a lot of people that you can't roast coffee because you can't see the color of it. So I developed my own process of roasting, so that I knew what color the coffee beans were. And in 2003, I started the company.
David, could you give him a hand with a mic here? That's an end fire mic. So
okay.
I know you're trying to talk into the side, but a lot of them are like that. A lot of them, you talk into the side of the mic, but this one is an end fire mic. So
that's great. Anyway, we started in 2003. I've got about 20 single bean coffees and 9 different blends. We do custom labeling for people. Here at the Hamvention, I've got 2 coffees. One we call Kilowatt Coffee. The other one we call Contester's Coffee. The Contester's Coffee is a single bean Malawi coffee from Malawi, Africa. The Kilowatt Coffee is a 3 bean coffee of Ethiopia, Panama, and Zambia. And then we've got a whole bunch of got a pot of coffee going continuously, so if you'd like to have a cup, why, come by and try it.
Well, I just got done drinking 2 cups of coffee. I don't know what coffee stand it came from.
Well, if you're in a contest that's going to go for 24 hours, you're going to need something strong.
Oh, you'll need Contester's Blend for that.
Contester's Blend. You've got Contester's Blend coffee. Now, is that where you got the coffee from?
No.
No, I drank somebody else's coffee earlier. I was falling asleep, you know, and we haven't had a whole lot of sleep coming down here to set up and coming up here to set up, I should say, from Nashville. Okay, where are you? Where are you from, there, Jerry?
I'm from Boulder, Colorado, which is near Denver.
And how are you connected with ham radio? How did you get into it? And what is your?
Well, I in 1962. I won an award in my Cub Scout troop for Morse code work with the flag. And then that same year, I got a really bad ear infection, and I had to stay home from school for a couple of weeks. And at that time, a friend of my father's gave me an old shortwave radio to listen to and play with. And I had asked my father, how do you talk on that thing like all these other guys do? And he said, well, you have to go get a license. You want to be a ham radio guy? And I said, sure. So he found an electronics store that at the time that offered licensing classes, and I got a novice, and I believe it was November of 63. I got my general in August of 64 and the advanced in August of 68, and I'm studying for the extra.
There you go. That's well, you know, I'll tell you something. I'm amazed at the ability of folks like yourself, and I guess that really, you know, and I don't want to, I guess I'm going to say major on a handicap, but it really behooves all the rest of us sighted individuals to take notice, you know, as to, you know, the amount of accomplishment that occurs in the lives of so many folks that are not sighted. I'm a very good friend. My very good friend is Ronnie Millsap. And Ronnie just totally amazes me. And I feel ashamed at times because sometimes I get a little discouraged or I feel like, oh, man, you know, life's really kicking me in the butt, you know. And then I understand that to him, every day is a major undertaking. And to be able to accomplish. Tell me a little bit about that. Tell me about the mindset, you know, that leads to the success in something when you're working against the odds.
I think it's drive. For me, I started my life as an auto mechanic. I learned that from my father as a child. I got interested in cars because I knew I couldn't drive them and I wanted something to do with them. So I got into the repair of that. So I started early in life doing something that a lot of people didn't think a blind guy could do. And then when I went to learn to roast coffee, an awful lot of people said you can't do it. You got to know what color the beans are. The only way you'll know that is to see them. And so it was kind of a contest of, okay, I guess I got to prove these guys wrong. I really want to roast coffee. I saw it done someplace once, and the guy showed me how to do it by sound. So I know you can. And darn it, I'm going to do it. And it's kind of like, I hate to put it in such simplistic terms, but it would be like daring someone to do something and or saying to a child, you can't do that. And the child says, oh, yeah? Sure I can. Mm-hmm. So you have to take a little more educated approach to that same commentary. But I just don't, you know, I'm the kind of person who doesn't want to live on a fixed income all their life. And it's a little more work than it might be if I had my vision, but I don't know. I never could see, so here I am.
So it's the company is called the Unseen Bean.
Yes,
the Unseen Bean. That's very cool. And you have a contester's blend.
We have a contester's blend, and we have a kilowatt blend.
Well, now I guess you have to work in some sort of a not just a contester's blend, but. For our friend Dr. Barrett over here, you're going to have to put together a special event blend.
We could do that. Now, what you'd have to do is you would have to sample a bunch of our coffees and tell me which one you like the best, and then we'd help you create a label for it.
You think that? I got Dr. Barrett over here shaking his head. A special event blend that would be brewed, I guess, for a special event station. It would be just like a contest station. You'd have to have the maximum amount of caffeine that you could cram into it for per
something,
bean.
Something to keep the body going for about another 24 hours or so. What I do have a question for Jerry, though, is as a non-sighted person, what modifications do you make to the radios so you know where the tuning is, know what frequency you're on, and things like that?
As far as most radios, we really can't modify them. The older analog radios that had dials, you could take the glass out and mark a couple places to feel the pointer. Some radios, you count the number of turns for the... I had a Swan 500C for a while, which I still have. And I believe every rotation of the dial was 5 kilohertz. And the way I figured that out is that radio had a 100 kilohertz crystal calibrator in it so that you could... find the tone, you know, every 100 kcs, and then you'd count the number of turns to the next 100 kcs and memorize where you were and try not to forget it. Some of the newer radios, such as some of the ICOMs and Kenwoods, do have a verbal readout for frequency and a few other things. And then these days, they're writing software that you can load on a cell phone to make them talk.
I was wondering if they had talking counters for radios, you know, like talking frequency counters. I don't know.
I think there's a company that makes one that reads the transmit frequency and would tell it to you.
You don't think about it. I mean, you really don't. We take so much for granted that it's... I know when Ronnie and I had a conversation one time, he was looking for a MP3 player, a Walkman. You know, and I began to think about my Zune player and the iPod, and they're also menu-sided driven, that it would be very difficult for someone to navigate that. There are some things that are just impossible, but there are things they make, what is it, adaptive software, they call it, and some of that stuff is pretty effective.
So there's a software package called Rockbox that loads onto some iPods or MP3 players to make them talk. Right now... you can get the latest, the fourth generation, what do they call the iPod that Macintosh makes?
Gosh, I don't know.
Like the iPod Nano and stuff like that. If you get the fourth generation one, you can connect it to your computer and it'll set up software to make the menus talk in that. And that's a new innovation that's less than a year old.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're an inspiration, and I really enjoyed having you come over here. And the call sign, once again, is...
Washboard 6 is very famous. WB6IVF. Come over to booth 302 and have a cup of coffee.
And the name of the company is called
The Unseen Bean.
The Unseen Bean. Oh, very good. Well, I'm looking forward to. I'm going to come over and sample the coffee, and I want to talk to you further. Fellow you need to meet over here is Dr. Barrett, the fellow from the TW Antenna Company, because he's into special event stations, and I think you guys need to really seriously talk about.
Oh yeah, and I'd
a
like
special
to,
event blend of.
Also, I'd like to learn about his antennas. What? I'm always looking for newer, better, smaller, fun antennas.
But the thing of it is, though, I don't think Dr. Barrett's a coffee drinker. I think he is a non-coffee drinker.
Oh, that's okay.
But you see, the thing of it is, when you're doing a special event, you got a lot of people that are there.
Well, and not all of them drink coffee either.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to go see the rest of the Hamfest here, Ted.
Okay.
And let Dr. Barrett join you on the air, and I want to thank you for having me as a guest on your show.
Well, I appreciate it.
My
come
privilege.
Back. We can talk about Cleveland and Detroit radio.
And the one other thing I wanted to mention about shortwave radio that a lot of the shortwave listeners will remember, and some of them are still used, I used to find it fascinating to listen to interval signals.
Interval signals.
That was when a station was getting ready to come on. It
would
put the carrier on about 2 minutes before they were supposed to go on.
And they would repeat the
and
same
they would
thing
have
over,
their,
and
like,
over
yeah,
and over.
Yeah, and it was fascinating stuff.
Well, you know, we did that with one radio show we were doing. We took the first five or six bars of the Tennessee Waltz and repeated it over and over and over. And you would not believe the number of people that did not know what that was or why we were doing it. They were all confused.
And it sounds familiar, but...
Yeah, exactly.
Alrighty. Thank you, Ted, for letting me be part of your show, and we'll be talking on the ham radio, too.
Alrighty. Thank you, and thank you very much, Jerry, for coming by.
You're very welcome, and I hope to hear this someday.
All right. We will have it on. We've got Dr. Michael Barrett sitting down to talk to us, and also from the American Radio Relay League, we have Bill, N2COP, and... you are the Bill is the head now of the PR committee. Is that what it is? Public relations committee.
That's it.
I couldn't. We got to decide what mic you're going to get on here. We can figure that out. And which mic do you prefer? This one or this one?
Let's try this one. Is that okay, Ted?
That's fine. That sounds very very good. Dr. Barrett, how are you doing today?
We're doing good. I'm excited, Ted. I mean. I didn't know how Dayton would do with the economy being what it is, gas up and down. But, boy, there are exhibitors on top of exhibitors, and as many people as was last year. And let me tell you that flea market tailgate area is absolutely loaded. If you want it, it is here at Dayton. And if you didn't make it to Dayton and you listen to the radio, get in the car and come tomorrow because it is – it's as good as I've ever seen. I'm as excited as I've ever been about Dayton this time.
I haven't been out to the flea market yet, you know. And you know, and also somebody else that's with us today that I want to get on the radio here before too long, and that's George McClintock, K4BTY, and he's.
You forgot my name, right?
George. I said George.
Well,
George.
The last McClintock. Name you stumbled over.
I did not stumble over your last name.
Well, shall I ask myself questions that you would normally be asking? When were you first licensed? You want to ask me that question?
Go ahead. When were you first licensed?
59.
Really?
18. No, I'm sorry. 1959. I'll get that right.
He's getting on up there.
That's right.
Well, we're gonna have George come back in because George got an interesting story to tell, we've got an interesting story to tell about George. He talked about shortwave radio. He goes back with shortwave radio. This is the gentleman that conceived the idea of putting four 100,000 watt transmitters in the city of Nashville. And successfully ran the operation for...
Caused a lot of sterilization all throughout the city, though.
four rhombic antennas down by the Cumberland River, okay? And then, of course, the people downstream couldn't figure out why the fish looked so weird, you know? But he operated WWCR for a number of years as the... part owner and general manager, and one of the most successful shortwave operations to ever come into existence.
Yes.
And stay long term, because there's been a lot of shortwave stations that have come and gone, because it's difficult to make a shortwave station work. But George will join us hopefully tomorrow. We'll get you on the mic, and
I'd be glad to.
And he's been over here helping us out with a booth and everything. Have you met Bill?
Okay. Hey, George.
And you can kind of tell. I want to make sure I get your title right.
I want to make sure I say it right.
Okay.
I'm the current chairman of ARL's Public Relations Committee.
Okay, very, very good. I know we've corresponded back and forth with email. And you guys are doing something different here. You're introducing this PR 101. You might want to share with the folks a little bit what that's all about.
Well, first of all, before we even start that, Ted, let me congratulate you on behalf of ARL for being the 2009 Bill Leonard Award winner. This award, for those who may not know, was bestowed upon you by ARL's Public Relations Committee for extraordinary work on behalf of amateur radio in general media. And we are very honored to have given that to you, and that you have done a stellar job in letting folks know about amateur radio through the medium of shortwave.
Well, I appreciate that. Believe me, it was I was kind of stunned by it when it came about. But it's like I've said a number of times, and that is that what makes this radio show work are all the various people that we have on the air, because there is no group of people that is more interesting and compelling to listen to than amateur radio operators. Now, these guys, all of them, have different facets of the hobby that they're into and accomplishments and things. As a matter of fact, the award winners this year, for the league's award winners this year for Dayton, the Dayton award winners are... It's unbelievable. I mean, this is like a magic combination of people that you can't. Where on earth can you find a group of people like this? You know.
Well, one of the things I congratulate you for, especially in coming here, is that for those of you listening who may not have been to Dayton, Dayton is magical. It is truly the mecca of amateur radio. It is if you're involved in this hobby, you owe it to yourself to come at least once and see all that there is, and to expand on what you just said, Ted. This is an amazing the hobby of amateur radio. The service of amateur radio is astounding in its depth of what it can offer anybody. You can get as involved, as little as you want, or as much as you want in this across so many spectrums. I don't mean just about modes. You can get involved in contesting, experimentation, public service, rag chewing. The versatility. That's, I think, what you're saying, is that people don't understand and appreciate the versatility of amateur radio. There's a wonderful word that politicians use called pluralism. Pluralism is really how multifaceted it is. And people don't realize until you come to Dayton how multifaceted, how pluralistic amateur radio is.
Oh, yeah. And you, as you look around all the different facets of we just had this fellow over here was talking about kit building, and that's become, I think, for a while a lost art, but now I can see that it's starting to come back. And I talked to a lot of people that are really wanting to roll up sleeves and build a kit, you know, and there isn't anything more exciting than that, you know, other than maybe possibly building something from scratch, you know, which is more difficult today because it's so much harder to find parts to put things together. One of the things I will say, one of the things that really caught my eye back, this has been about almost 2 years ago, is I was at a ham fest, and I was walking through, and I looked over, and I saw this antenna, but I didn't know what it was, because it didn't look like an antenna. I thought, well, what is this thing? And then later on, I found out it was an antenna, and it was a low-profile, kind of a stealth antenna. But it was something that would enable a technician who was living in an apartment who couldn't necessarily upgrade because they had nowhere to put an antenna. A person could get one of these and put it on their balcony And we had talked about the fact that there were some people that were hanging plants on the thing to make it look like a planter or something, which only shows the ingenuity of radio amateurs. But this thing literally would enable thousands of hams who couldn't put any sort of an antenna up to put something up that actually worked really, really well. And that caught my eye. I thought, this is a good thing, because this opens a door. And I don't know how many times I talked to somebody who was a tech, and I'd say, are you ever going to get upgraded to the general? And they would say, no, not really. And the reason why is I don't have any place to put an antenna, so there's not much point in me going after the license.
Right.
You know. And, of course, when you got something like this, it just takes that excuse completely and totally away. And it opens that door for a lot of people to think about the possibilities of being able to operate 17-meter DX, 20-meter DX. And, of course, as our sunspots come back, which we are hoping that they will someday.
We had an encouraging report this past week.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've all been waiting too long. I mean, anything you can get is encouraging. But to see that... that we had some activity take place. Apparently solar flux was up dramatically the last 2 days. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
Tell Bill here and the folks that are listening a little bit about the concept behind this antenna when you first started.
Well, Ted, what we really built the antenna. The market we were going after was really two markets. The guy that lived in a deed-restricted or covenant-restricted dwelling who couldn't have an antenna. The neighbors wouldn't let him. The homeowners association wouldn't let him. And he needed something that could sit on the balcony or the patio that would really work, not a dummy load, but something that he could really put up and take put out and take up and talk on when he wanted to talk. And it needed to be effortless. It needed to work. It needed to be well-built. If he was going to spend $1,000 for a new rig, $1,500, he needed an antenna that looked like it was worthy of the rig. The second group we wanted to support was the people who really weren't backpackers, but they're older guys like me that wanted to get in the car or the four-wheel drive and go somewhere or go on vacation and throw the antenna and radio in the trunk and pull it out and set the picnic table, be at the lake with the family, be on vacation and use the antenna. And I think we've done a good job with those markets. What we didn't realize was there were so many people that had gotten to the point they couldn't deal with towers, they couldn't deal with stringing wires in trees. They really wanted something that would make life easy on them. And we've really sold the antenna to the general market. We tell folks it's a portable antenna, but... I believe we sell as many for permanent installation now as we do for portable installation. So,
well, it's interesting. I got an email here, you know, and this email was, I think, was Bobby. Let me see here. Is it Bobby? Bob. N2BR. Is that Bobby Raymer?
Yes, N2BR.
Yeah, he says, hey Ted, tell Michael, N4ECW. I worked TC3DEU in Izmir, Turkey, last night on 20 meters with the TW2010 and 100 watts. See, so now...
Wow.
Does that, you know, that opens the door. Can you imagine somebody that's just got their this is, you know, just got their general ticket, you know, or has a technician, and right, knowing that they can do this and they can operate in an area where they normally just would be so restricted they couldn't.
Well, let me jump in here, Ted, and I'm going to take off my hat as chairman of AR's Public Relations Committee, and I'm going to put on my hat as an operator. You were at the PR forum that we had here at Hamvention just a little while ago this
Correct.
Afternoon.
Right.
And I shared with everybody the results of what newly joined members of ARRL were looking for. The number one thing they were looking for was just casual operating, but the number two thing they wanted to do was mobile or portable operating. And, Michael, I haven't used your product yet, but I want to just tell folks out there listening about what it's like, the thrill, to do portable work. I'm a QRP'er. And I wish I could say I'm not kit building. Shame on me. So I'm not. I haven't put an Ellicraft yet together, but I own a Tentec Argonaut 516, and I own a Yaesu FT817, and that Yaesu is a good companion of mine. I go lots of places with that, and one of my great thrills has been going all sorts of places and working portable. I live near the beach. I live in coastal North Carolina. And for me, it is great to be able to go down to the beach on an afternoon and take a rig and work all sorts of places. So, I'll take some QRO sometime. I'll take my larger rigs. I'll take my ICOM 706. And so, Michael, thank you for opening up that market. It's a great market in which to open.
Bill, we enjoy it. We have a lot of fun. We started out in 2005 with three employees. We're up to about a dozen now. We probably have, 1,200, 1,500 antennas in the field. We've had a lot of fun. We started out with a 2010. Now we've got the 30-meter antenna, the 40-meter antenna, the 60-meter antenna, and 80-meter antenna. We have we tell everybody, if you buy it and you don't like it, it doesn't suit you, it doesn't work for you, you send it back and we'll refund 100% of your money. And in the last 4 years, we've not had a single product returned to us like that. But I do think we've got Bill at a disadvantage here, Ted. We're having him talk about the TW2010, and he's the public relations committee person for the ARRL. So let me give a disclaimer. The ARRL in no way is endorsing TW antennas.
No, and that's why I said I took off my hat.
Well, one thing I did want to talk about, though, I did want to talk about the ARRL, and for several reasons. I think that one thing that we kind of, I think a lot of hams overlook, you know, there's a lot of us, and but not all hams are members of the league.
No, it's about 25% are, about 75% in the United States, 75% are not.
Okay, now, I have a theory. I think the reason why that is I think most of them, they just don't think about it. In other words, it isn't that they're opposed to the league. They don't dislike the league. It's just that it's just for some reason not in their window. They don't see it. It's not in their sight. And it's places like this that I kind of like to get on a soapbox just a little bit and say, you know, we really do need the organization that the league provides in the protection of our frequencies and all the different things that they do that are so encompassing that most people aren't even aware of most of the stuff that goes on at league level, where they're interfacing the FCC or some other government agency on the behalf of amateurs all across the country.
Well, Ted, let me put some things into context, I think, which might be good. And first of all, I'm not a staff member of ARL. I'm not paid by ARL. I'm a field member. In fact, I'm not even a life member of ARRL. I've been a appointed public information officer for ARRL, I think, for about 8 years. I've been the North Carolina, what's known as PIC, Section PIC, Public Information Coordinator, for 4 years. And I was asked by Joel Harrison, the president of ARRL, to serve as the National Public Relations Committee chairman for this year. I don't receive compensation from ARRL, which puts me at an advantage in that I do this out of pure love. I don't need this, and in the sense that I'm trying to do this for the hobby. I don't agree with everything that ARRL does, but you know, ARRL is like family. You don't always agree with your family, and
that's exactly the case. And I've said this on the air before, and I know it sounds kind of crazy. A lot of folks have gotten crossways. And I get a lot of people will get on me and they say, well, you support the ARRL and, you know, we don't like the... And I tell them, well, why don't you? And I get into a conversation with them, and most of the time I find out it's one person that they ran across at some point in time that just really ticked them off.
You know? Well,
you know, and I tell them, you know, you can't judge the group by one. You know, and what you need to do is renew your membership, jump back in the scheme of things, and if there's something you don't like, work toward getting that change. Do something constructive, but be a part of it.
Be a part of it. Anything that you really want to do in life is an investment, and that is an investment of your time, your energy, your passion, and at times, your money. And that means that $39 a year. Now, what do you get for that? And I don't want to make it sound like a commercial. What's the alternative? The thing that frustrates me, and I'm beginning to, now that I'm serving as chairman this year of ARL's Public Relations Committee, I'm beginning to see surveys. Because part of what public relations is, you need to educate the public in general, as well as the amateur radio community, what is going on. And my concern is that there are too many outside forces that either don't understand or don't even know about amateur radio. And yes, we can all have a family feud, and we do. We have it. I mean, we know we're very passionate people. And just because one guy does CW doesn't mean that everyone's got to do CW. And some guy does fox hunting, you have to do fox hunting. We can all, this gets back to what I just said a few minutes ago about pluralism. We can all exist. But we all share one goal in common, and that common goal is to keep amateur radio alive and vibrant. And there is no one answer on how to do that. And the ARL may not have the perfect answer for you, but deep down, the interest of the league is that it is trying to preserve and enhance amateur radio as we know it. And let's take the issue last year about regulation of bandwidth by application or mode rather than full frequency spectrum. That the you can digital communications, you can package it 6,000 ways to Sunday. And so you're beginning to defy what it is as far as what the mode is that's going there. It doesn't matter what's going down the pipeline. How much spectrum is it taking up? That's really what the issue is. And like it or not, the train has left the station. And I think we all know that those who like some traditional technologies, we're not saying you can't do them. We're just saying that there are emerging technologies that the horse is out of the barn. They're there. You have to address how they're going to coexist with traditional applications. While you're doing this, we have too much spectrum right now that's been given to amateur radios that's not being underutilized, that frankly is going to be in jeopardy of being taken by other interests unless somebody fights for our behalf. Now, do I agree with every single thing the ARL is doing? No, of course not. But what's the alternative? Where's my most logical voice to which I can turn to represent what interests I do have? And I wandered in here, Ted. I didn't mean to take Michael's time, but let's take him as an example of what he does with Trans World antennas and how he builds those. This gets back to what I just said earlier. Well, we mentioned that 75% of American hams do not belong to ARL. As you know, Ted and Michael, we have a lot of inactivity in the amateur radio community. There may be 650,000 licensed, but at any given time, there's probably 300. I'm guessing. I don't know the exact number. There's probably around 300,000, I'm guessing, or roughly half, who are truly, truly active. We got to tell these people there's just way too much fun out there of things that they can do. And that's why, exactly, you mentioned, Michael, all these people have approached you over the years and said, I live in an apartment. How can I get on the air? How can I do something meaningful? How can I do something fun? Don't give up. Get out and do something. I don't care what it is. Try something new. And in the process, you're going to utilize the bands. You're going to become more of an advocate and a spokesperson for the hobby. And you need to get out and do something. As I said earlier today at the Public Relations Forum here at the Dayton Hamvention, I honored one of our colleagues who just stepped down as a 10-year member of the ARL Public Relations Committee, Jim McDonald, KB9LEI. Jim is the one who coined the phrase, every ham is a PIO, meaning a public information officer. Every ham is a PIO, every ham is an ambassador. And that's true. Every time you meet somebody who's not a ham, you're representing what amateur radio is. And if the person sees that you're not active and that maybe all you are is dogmatically opposing something against the league, that's an image that you're leaving. And I'm saying that, again, there are constructive ways in which you can let your voice be heard that you disagree with the league. And that is needs to be done. And, you know, we do have these other outlets. There are you can go and post a blog on EHAM. I'm just going to use it as an example. You can write a letter to CQ magazine. You don't have to. There are ways you can get a message out if you feel it's not being accepted by the league. And that's why they exist. And that's fine. That's healthy. But let's know that there's a lot of people who would love to take over our spectrum.
Bill, if all the ARRL did in the last 2 years was beat back broadband over power lines, they were worth the $39 from every ham that has a license in North America. The ARRL does things that we all don't like. But they do a lot of good things. The magazine by itself is worth the price of the membership. The good work that the ARRL does in promoting the hobby to folks who aren't hams, to schools, to colleges, to organizations, the PR work that they are tireless in their efforts to always get ham radio to the forefront. They do so much for so many people that I think we all ought to belong to the ARRL. If you don't spend the $39, I don't think you have the right to complain, Bill. Now, I'm going to step back and not be the president of Transworld Antennas, but just be a ham radio operator. If I pay my $39 and I don't like something, I'm going to write you guys a letter and say, hey, guys, I don't like it. But if I don't pay my $39 and I'm not part of the club, then I really don't think I've got a right to whine. So I would tell everybody, guys, you're buying rigs that cost $1,000. You're spending this is not a cheap man's hobby. You can get in it cheaply and not spend a lot of money. But a lot of folks in ham radio spend a lot of money, and $39 is a bargain for what we get from the ARRL. And I know I'm going to get a lot of emails on my website about this, but, guys, let me tell you, who have we got out there fighting for us other than the ARRL? If we don't support them and they have to cut back their services or their people, we need them. They need us, but we need them. Spend the $39. Keep hammering, Ted. We'll keep sponsoring you.
Well, you know, the thing of it is, though, too, and that is the interface that the league has right now with the Federal Communications Commission. In other words, here is a very strange relationship. You have the American Radio Relay League that enjoys a great relationship with the Federal Communications Commission via Riley Hollingsworth,
right,
and now the new lady Laura Smith. Okay, they have this fantastic relationship where they keep amateur radio's image polished, and they work all the tarnish off and keep the polish on it so it sparkles and it looks good, okay? But then on the other hand, the league can turn around and sue the FCC and win and still maintain the status of a good guy. Now, how in the world? There is nothing else I know of on the planet that fits that description.
Mike Bill, explain that one.
Yeah.
Well, again, now let's clarify for your listeners, and I'll reintroduce myself. Some folks are just tuning in. My name is Bill Maureen. My call sign's N2COP, and I'm not an ARL staffer, but I'm serving as a volunteer this year to head up ARL's National Public Relations Committee, just to put some things into context. I think in many ways, amateur radio in general and ARRL are to be commended for making our use of our spectrum self-regulating, self-policing. And that, by the way, that is both admirable and at the same time, that kind of puts us under the radar screen. Let me put that into context. Again, the Family Feud thing. In many ways, we take care of ourselves. By that I mean when we have problems, we have the capability in many instances to control those people who misuse our spectrum. And I think the FCC likes that. We're not a big problem to them. And once in a while we get a case where, yes, we do, we can't take care of it. We have to enlist the help of the FCC to go in and take care of people within our spectrum. But largely, 99% of the time, we're pretty good. We take care of ourselves. That's, I think, an amazingly positive attribute. It says a lot about amateur radio, that we don't cause problems and we go out of our way to try and help. The downside is, in all honesty, we're not terribly visible. We're a nonprofit organization. We don't have the resources. And let me, Ted, if I can for a second, this is one of my pet peeves. I think an awful lot of amateurs think that the league has deep pockets. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but any ham can, the league is a public nonprofit. Any ham can call up ARL in Newington, order its annual report. And if you haven't seen it, that is an amazing document. And when you look at the numbers, and I mean the actual numbers in terms of money, ARL, yes, it's a big institution, but the numbers behind that institution are not that vast. And I think even I was somewhat amazed at how much ARL can do with as little as it has. I mean, it is really, it is not a, and all nonprofits have been hit by the recession going on right now. So I think with what they have to work with, for the amount of staff that they have, and I don't know what the number is, I think there are 120 full-time staffers, I think they really do a heck of a job. And I say that out of respect of it as an institution, to see what it is. And this gets back to the basic question. If I had to mount a campaign in support of amateur radio and the league was not around, I don't know where I'd turn. I don't know what resources I could turn to speak on my behalf. Mm-hmm. So that I don't want to make it sound like an overall pitch, because, again, getting back to the concept of family, there's plenty of times I disagree with the league. But you know what? There are plenty of times I disagree with my wife and my kids, but I'm still happily married, and my kids have turned out okay.
I sometimes, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it, I get a big charge out of Alan Pitts. Alan is incredible in terms of what he does for public relations. He's the public relations director, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, his title is he's public relations and media manager for ARL. He is the paid staffer. By the way, he's the only person that does public relations for ARL. It's a one-person shop. He does not have a staff of thousands. It's just Alan.
Well, he does a tremendous job. He motivates people. He's got all these PIOs that are constantly posting things. But what I was just going to say, though, is he is absolutely the ultimate diplomat, because you'll see guys get up against each other and you see fur being rubbed a little bit backwards. You know, one guy rubs the other guy's fur a little backwards, you know, and you see this. And he's got the ability somehow to pull all this together and settle it all down and calm everybody down and get the game back to rolling again, you know. And I watch this happen repeatedly over and over, because you can't get a group of human beings together all under one roof and expect everybody to see eye to eye all the time. It's not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. And you know, Ted, I come from North Carolina, in the North Carolina section. We have a nice young section manager, a guy by the name of Tim Slay, N4IB. And I was sitting, and we have quarterly teleconference calls on the section. We have 18,000 hams licensed in the state of North Carolina, and about 4,000 of those, same ratio as nationally, are ARL members. So once a quarter, the officers or the appointees, the section officers of North Carolina, get on the telephone and discuss what's going on around the state of North Carolina relative to amateur radio. And we'll hear about these little pockets of disputes that go on. And, of course, they go on in all sections. And some of them have been going on for a while. And you say to people, why can't we resolve this? We all share a common hobby. Wouldn't you think that we would all be in harmony? And I think Tim was very prescient with his comment about how he said. His answer is, you know, we're all wildly passionate. Those of us who are active are wildly passionate about what it is we do. And when you mix passion into the formula, people get pretty adamant. And passion can sometimes distort the bigger picture. And that was a very good observation on his part. And when you come to here like Dayton, you can see this. I mean, Dayton, in addition to the Hamvention itself and all the vendors and everything here, it's a forum of passions. And that's what's great. You know, Michael, with your antennas, Trans World antennas, you're getting, I'm sure, a lot of people that are passionate about portable operations, passionate about doing stuff. You know, Ted, if I can turn things around a little bit again, we got back, as I mentioned earlier, the survey. I love surveys. Maybe that's just my background. I had studied sociology in college. I spent a lot of time in marketing and polling. I had a neat job one time in New Jersey. I actually worked for a company that was one story down in the building from a major Gallup polls. And it was fun to just sit in the lunchroom and talk to pollsters and polling. But in the people, again, out of the 168,000 members of ARL, the number one thing that people want to do most is just rag chew and have casual operation. And the next favorite activity is portable operations, mobile operations. And here's the one, the kicker that surprised me. Contesting is way down on the list. So what that says to me is that contesters are very vocal, very passionate, and in some cases affluent subsection. But they're very much a minority within amateur radio as a whole.
But you'd never know that.
No, what it really showed us is that they are the tail that wags the dog.
Well, now sitting across the way here from you, Dr. Barrett is, I call him the special event, the king of special event amateur radio stations. He loves special event stations. And I think sometimes he could just invent a reason to have a special event station, although he's had some pretty outstanding ones. But I think that the special event station is an area where a station comes on the air and people work that station at their leisure. The special event station works other people at their leisure, but they have a chance to do something. They're not necessarily in the contesting arena,
right?
And they have a little bit more chance to discuss in depth with the people that they're talking to, rather than just exchanging the typical 599 and moving along, you know.
One of the things we've noticed in our special events, Ted, we sponsor way too many special events, and we send out the real nice certificates and pay the postage for anybody that checks in. But you would be surprised how the general public really, really enjoys special events. We've done different Confederate generals at different places where they were very famous. We did most recently, the 90th anniversary of Alvin C. York's heroics over in France in World War I, did N4Y. And, boy, it absolutely, the Alvin C. York Foundation supported it. The York family supported it. The military supported it. We got press coverage everywhere. And special events done right. Not what I'd call inbred special events, which is the 15th anniversary of our local ham club, but a true special event really benefits. It's like a miniature field day. In your community, you've got really two opportunities to showcase ham radio, other than a disaster, which we hope doesn't happen, but field day and a special event. In fact, I probably got more interest in our areas where we did special events than field days, so... And there are people, I love working special events. I collect the paper, Bill, so I get on the weekends and I get the list out of the QST magazine and off the web page, and I see what's out there, and I try to work those special event stations.
I collect them too, Michael, because, and by the way, let me tip my hat to you. I'm going to put back on my hat as chairman of ARL's Public Relations Committee. Special events, to me, are the perfect way to showcase to the public what amateur radio is about and what it can do. And you made a very special point, Michael, and that is you do it in a non-adverse or non-disaster setting. And that is a very positive image that you can give to amateur radio.
Hold on.
That's good. I have another hobby. Mine is railroading, and not models. I like the big stuff, big trains. And so there's a lot of special event stations that originate from railroad museums and from different railroad venues, and I chase after those. I enjoy those a lot. So hats off to you for doing that.
Well, you know, when they print up certificates to give out, though, the ones I got one of the certificates. And these things are gorgeous.
They are
just unbelievable. Well, I mean, I've seen other certificates, but, I mean, what they print up, I don't know what it costs them to do a certificate, but these things are not just suitable for framing. I mean, these are like pieces of art, you know, that go up.
Ted, on the York event, we gave away the certificates, but the foundation actually gave away two. Just say what they told me was when you get through, put everybody's call sign in a hat and draw out two, and we're going to give away two special event York commemorative knives. They were the Congress style knives. The blades were engraved commemorating the 90th anniversary. Had York's picture and something on every blade. And two of the folks that worked that event got these knives. And the foundation was selling the things for like $150 a piece. So one of these days, those knives will be their collector's items. So we had a lot of support from the foundation. And I think if you're real creative, if your club really wants to get new members and wants to make an impact, boy, do a real good special event and involve the public in it.
Mm, yeah, I'll tell you what. When you set up in a especially in a public location, you know, and you do a special event, it's like magic because people come by and they don't know what ham radio is and they see what you're doing and you know I want to have you do your thing here for me. The subject came up at the public relations meeting as to, you know, how do you tell other people about the hobby and do it concisely, do it quickly. You know, we really are living in an age where ham radio is foreign to this newer generation. They have no idea what it is.
It really is, Ted. And you want my elevator speech? Is that what you're talking?
And then let me just say real quick for those who just tuned in, we are coming to you live from Dayton. It's the 2009 Dayton Hamvention. So that's what this broadcast is. I'm talking with Bill Moraine, N2COP, and N4ECW Michael Barrett, Dr. Barrett from Transworld Antennas. And Bill, give us the explanation. You've got this down. So
all right, I'll tell you. And let me tell your listeners, too, because I think this is very important, not just for listeners in the United States, I think for listeners worldwide, that, and this is an issue unto itself, amateur radio is an aging hobby. I don't necessarily mean that negatively. That could be a whole other issue for another time. But the average age in, I shouldn't say the United States, a league membership, the average age of a league member is 62 years old. And I bring that up only for one reason, and that is most members have been amateur radio operators for a long time. It's in our blood. We know what it is. And until cell phones became pretty common 10 years ago, most people had an inkling, if they weren't hams, as to what amateur radio was and what it meant in the community. Here's the problem. Increasingly now, we're getting reporters, journalists, even some younger government officials who are under the age of 35 who may not have had any exposure to amateur radio. And hams do a great job, but hams in themselves usually are not great promoters. And so they'll do a great job in the background and maybe even doing emergency communications in the background. But public information offices around the country are having this problem increasingly. I'll give you a scenario. Field day, it's a weekend. Most reporters who work on the weekend for a television station or for a newspaper are usually young cub reporters starting out. They're typically 22 to 25 years old, and the only phone they have known may be a cell phone. And that may be their only context of two-way wireless communications. A lot of these stations, particularly in their newsrooms, they used to have two-way radio systems are using cell phones now. So again, reinforcing the cell phone as the ultimate two-way vehicle. So those of us who need to, this is my point I want to make to listeners. The big point is do not assume that when you speak to the public for the first time, that the person you're speaking to may really understand what amateur radio is or what ham radio is. And so what Ted was referring to, what I call the elevator speech. This is, if you go to any business motivational training, it's very common to term what the elevator speech. And the scenario is somebody that you really, really have wanted to make contact with, or either for a job or for some other opportunity, walks in an elevator and doesn't know who you are. And you're going to be with them for 30 seconds. And they turn to you and say, "What is it that you do?" And so you have 30 seconds before that other person gets off their floor on the elevator. And you have 30 seconds in which to tell them what it is that you do or what you're about. And so what Ted's talking about is every ham, remember, go back to what I said a few minutes ago, every ham is a PIO, meaning every ham is a public information officer, every ham is an ambassador, every member, every ham, when they come in contact with a person who's not a licensed amateur, is representing amateur radio. They're representing what the hobby is and what it represents. So, Ted wanted me to tell what is my 30-second elevator speech, and here it is. I've got it tailored for where I'm from in North Carolina. So, amateur radio is a century-old, systematic, and proven two-way form of electronic communications staffed by professionally licensed electronics communications volunteers that are 650,000 strong in the United States, 18,000 strong in the state of North Carolina, and 1,500 strong in my hometown area. It's a hobby. It's the world's original chat room. It's a safe chat room. And they are best known for their public service in providing emergency communications when other forms of electronic communications, such as landline phones, cell phones, and the internet, all cease to work. You see them after hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, and unfortunately, man-made disasters such as blackouts and terrorist attacks. If you have a ham radio operator living in your neighborhood, you have a public safety official every bit as valuable as a policeman, a fireman, an EMT, or a doctor or a nurse living next door to you. A ham radio operator is your friend. All right, so my 30 seconds. It was a long elevator ride.
Very, very good. Very good. Now, I'm going to give you the lighter side of the story.
All right.
My son, Matt, is 24 years old. I have two sons. One son is David, and the other, he's 28, and the younger one is Matt, and he's 24. And he just put a large, large Tar Heel on the back of his Volvo. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yes,
it's a Volvo. Yeah. Okay, so now, he's driving along in traffic, and now we're talking about the fact that ham radio is somewhat foreign to people today. So he has a very twisted sense of humor, just like I do. And he's driving along in traffic, and some guy's flagging at him, you know, waving at him. You know. He rolls the window down, and the guy says, "What is that on the back of your car?" Okay? He did this the other day, and I like to fell out of the car. He turns around like he's looking in his, you know, turns his neck all the way around like he's looking through the back window of the car. And he turns around and goes back to the guy. And he says, "Oh, my God." He says, "What is that on the back of my car?" It's this look on his face. And of course, the fellow that was asking, you know, you think, you know, please show the guy some mercy. But no. He's like, "Whoa, what is it? What's on the back of my car?" You know? So, I mean, but when we're in traffic and somebody sees an amateur antenna, especially the size of the large Tar Heel,
yeah,
they're wondering, what on earth is that? You know, because you don't see them very often, you know.
No.
And that's a good door opener to make that speech. It really is. You know, and that's a good thing. That's what some, I guess every ham has the opportunity to do at some point in time. Because at some point in time, somebody is going to get onto the fact that you're into this hobby.
Yeah, and you need to have, again, get it gets back. Every ham is a PIO. Every ham is an ambassador. You should have your canned speech ready to go.
So do you have your canned speech?
I just got it. I listened and I'll cannibalize it and it'll be mine.
Well, cannibalize. I mean, Michael, you should have one saying, "I bring satisfaction and joy to those who are licensed but may have constraints as to for successful operating."
Right.
That's really the business you're in.
What I really like to do, Bill, and you hit on this two or three times. I'll tell you a story. On Thanksgiving Day, my wife and I decided we was going to go to Key West, was going to rent a boat, and we were going to go out about 20 miles offshore, and we were going to put the TW-2010 on the front of the boat, and we were going to see who we could talk to on Thanksgiving Day. So on 17 meters, didn't do 20 meters, on 17 meters we got out there. What we had for lunch was chicken biscuits from McDonald's that we brought at breakfast. And I tell you, it was the most memorable Thanksgiving I believe I ever had. It may not have been the number one, but it was within, I'm 52 years old, it was in the top three or four I ever had. And I was in a boat on 20 miles west of Key West at a place called Woman Key, and I was working North America. I didn't work Europe, but I band wasn't that great, but I worked North America. I had a pile up going like I was a rare DX station. Had the time of my life. Before that, about this time last year, went to Yellowstone, took my wife, got out at Shoshone Lake in the middle of a snowstorm, about this time of year, set up, and had the time of my life again, portable. You really said it. If you want to have fun, take your family, grab a rig, throw an antenna in, whether it's my antenna, whether it's a ham sticks, a buddy pole, a wire strung in a tree. Of course, I'd like for you to use mine, but if that's not the case, just get something and get out there and go portable, and you'll have the time of your life, Bill.
Michael, I couldn't agree more with you. My sons are now 19 and 20 years old, but one of the great things we did for them when they were younger, from ages 5 through 12, we had them enrolled in a karate program, Taekwondo. And because obviously they couldn't drive, and that meant 3 days a week, I used to take my portable gear with me. So for the hour that they were in the Taekwondo studio, I would take out my rig, I would take out a battery, and I'd take out a portable antenna. And I was using an Outbacker, which was fine at the time, mm-hmm. and I would work all over the place. And it was a lot of fun. Portable operating is a lot of fun. In fact, it's funny you mentioned what you just said, that you had one of the top three or four experiences of your life. Something we can talk about another time, Ted, was that I served on staff at K2BSA. That's the Boy Scout station at the National Jamboree held every 4 years. And I came back from my first jamboree having worked as a staff person at K2BSA in 2001. And my wife said to me, "Did you have a good time?" And I said, "Dear, it was one of the top five experiences of my life." And she said to me, "I hope those five include our marriage and the birth of our two children."
Oh, my.
And I came back to her and I said, "Dear," I said, "this is one of the top eight experiences of my life."
Well, we have a local group in the Nashville area that I've listened to them working with the Boy Scouts on 2 meters and making contacts, and it is incredible to hear what these folks do. So I can only imagine. After hearing it, I know the kind of mood it put me in listening to it. So,
well, I've taken portable stations out camping. Both my boys, by the way, went on. They're both hams. I'll put a plug in, W4GHM and W4RSM. And they're both Eagle Scouts now. They're in college. But when I was their scout leader, a scout leader in their troop, I used to operate portable all the time. And what a great way to expose young people to amateur radio.
We've gone over, but I just talked to Jennifer at the radio station at the transmitter site, and she, you know, so she's accommodating us for a few more minutes.
All right.
And I don't want to wear out our welcome here.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer.
I want to say that and this is, I guess, in the form of a, maybe a commercial, the thing that has really intrigued me is that they have come up with this antenna now, which is the same body of the 2010, but this thing operates on 80 meters. And, I mean, there's so many. I love the 75, 80-meter band. I like its the localness of it, you know, or you call it regional local. I like that, you know. And you get with a group of guys that you get to know, and you check in every night, and you hear them. And I hang out a lot on 3875. And there's some really, really neat people that hang out on 3875. And Bob Heil is one of them. You'll hear Bob up there all the time testing a microphone, which is always interesting, you know. And but for a lot of folks, I mean, you're looking at, you know, 65 feet per side for a dipole, and then trying to find some place to stretch that thing in your backyard. In a lot of cases, it just isn't going to happen, especially for somebody that lives in an apartment complex or a condo or something like that. So it's unheard of to think that here's an antenna that you can put up and tear down in 2 minutes and 50 seconds, which the video shows over here, you know. And they can, I mean, now I'll tell you, it's probably not going to, that antenna is not going to perform like a double extended Zep, you know, but you are on the air, and it's head and shoulders over a mobile, you know, over operating off of a mobile antenna or some makeshift thing. I mean, it really is. And they make that 40-40 section that's for 40 meters, and now, of course, our broadcast folks have moved off the bottom end of the band. That's kind of nice, you know. I see a lot of good things that Dr. Barrett's into here with this antenna company, and like you said, enabling folks to, and, you know, we are getting to the point where hams, and I don't know if this is good or bad, but hams, for the most part, a lot of it, because of even time restraints, we're all becoming more appliance operators than we used to be.
We are.
You know, and it isn't. I don't know that it's totally a bad thing. I think a lot of it has to do not with the lack of creativity or the lack of wanting to do or the lack of skill or knowledge. It comes to a point of having a lack of time, because it takes time to tinker with things. You know?
I couldn't agree more. I've got, I don't know how many kits I've got in my QTH that I haven't built. That because when I'm home, I'm busy doing other things. I've got my own business, and it's just tough to get on the air. That's why I like working portable, because it's dedicated. I do it deliberately, so I get out of the house. I don't have distractions, and it's a chance to go operate in public.
I think it's you know, and we're all in that kind of thing. We're all squeezed into a corner. And I understand what you're talking about, being able to grab something portable, go out and set it up, especially when it goes together so quickly, so effortlessly. But on top of that, with their product, it looks good, too. It doesn't look like, you know, two broom handles connected up to a ladder or something.
Ted, let me mention one thing that we hardly ever say about the company, but two things that I think is that we're proud of. One is... except for a few electrical components in the 2010, everything about that 2010 is made right in Cookeville, Tennessee, by Tennesseans, number one. Number two, those Tennesseans are severely disabled. We're not a 501c3 company. We're a for-profit company. But basically, the folks work for me, with exception of my engineer, would not be competitive in the normal workplace. So I managed another company that was a 501c3 and got it up and going and turned it over to somebody else now to run, and took some of those employees, and that's who makes these antennas. It's Tennesseans using everything from Tennessee except a few electrical components and one model, and it's folks who are severely disabled. And, yes, they are paid competitive wages as much as anybody in the town makes.
That's fantastic.
It's admirable.
And I can brag about it because I've been in a wheelchair ever since I was a child. I'm severely disabled. I worked in the competitive marketplace, and the Lord blessed me. I had a good life, made a lot of money, got a lot of education, and providing this opportunity for these folks. And so when you buy an antenna, that's who's building it. And if you've ever seen one, touched one, or handled one, used one, they work, and they're well-built, Ted.
That I know, because I've played with one myself. I've got one right now in the backyard, and I've been it's kind of spooky. I was telling, I'm up on the 17-meter band, and I hear this DX station, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, I need to get back on the ZEP, because I got the ZEP with a balance line and the Johnson kilowatt matchbox there, and I'm thinking, I need to get back on that ZEP so I can really hear this guy. And I switch the antenna over to the ZEP, and all of a sudden the noise goes up and the signal goes down, and I'm like, how does this little thing work like this, you know? How did they get this thing? It's like unbelievable, you know? So, but I've had a lot of fun. I haven't had much time to operate, you know, lately, or over the last couple of years. A lot of it's because I spent a lot of my time producing this radio show and doing interviews. But over the last couple of weeks, I actually took the time to get on 20 and 17 and make contacts, and it just kind of blew me away. I was one afternoon, I got on and I worked a guy in Italy, and I worked a guy in France, and I worked a guy in the was it Canary Islands?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. Maybe it was the Canary Islands. I think it was. I don't know. Anyways, and the guy in the Canary Islands, he kept asking me to repeat what I was saying, you know, and I thought, well, it's working awful well for a small antenna sitting on the ground and all that. And then it was just a few minutes later I realized I was using a little Elenco that I had it on low power, which is like about 5 watts. So I was doing all of this on 5 watts and didn't even know it. I was a QRP-er and didn't have any idea. And I thought, well, you know, I don't feel bad at all that the fella asked me to repeat a couple of things, because it was a wonder to me to make that many contacts, you know. So, and that's really cool. Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming by and sharing with us. I really, really appreciate it. And the same thing, Dr. Barrett. We're going to be back on tomorrow. We'll be on it starting. And for all those folks that are listening, let me just tell you what you're listening to. This is a live broadcast originating from the Dayton Hamvention 2009 in Dayton, Ohio, the largest ham radio function on Earth. This is the biggest tent that you can come to. And there's everything going on here. We've been talking with Bill Maureen, and Bill is the head of the Public Relations Committee for the American Radio Relay League. We're also talking to Dr. Michael Barrett, who is the owner of the Trans World Antenna Company. And I want to thank both of you fellas. Any parting remarks here before Jennifer gets to go home and cook dinner?
Guys, if you're out there and you make it to Dayton, come to Dayton. They've got everything. It's ham radio heaven. You can't miss it. Get in the car now, drive all night, come to Dayton. You'll thank me for coming.
The other thing, too, I want to say, go up to our website and shoot us an email. Go to tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. Shoot us an email and tell us you're listening, and we'll read your email tomorrow on the air, and we'll talk about you here. Go ahead, Bill.
Ted, thank you for the opportunity not only to get on here. Thank you for all you're doing to educate listeners around the world by shortwave about ham radio. And let me say, echo what Michael said, is if you want to come in the world's biggest toy box, this is it.
Thank you very, very much, and I appreciate it. We shall leave you now. We'll be back tomorrow at exactly 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern Daylight Time, right here, same time, same frequency, for a special edition of QSO.